Hi, this is Steve Roost, and you're listening to Health Tech Hour on UK Health Radio. Each week, we give you the best news, views, and interviews from the health technology world. From CEOs and founders to entrepreneurs and clinicians, the companies and people that are shaping the future face of healthcare. All on the world's number one talk health radio. Hello and welcome to this week's Health Tech Hour with me, Steve Roost. Each week, we bring you the best news, views and interviews with the leaders, clinicians, CEOs, investors and journalists who are changing the face of healthcare in the UK and beyond. As regular listeners know, I am a CEO and founder of a health tech business myself, which is called PocDoc. PocDoc's flagship product is the Healthy Heart Check, which is now available on the high street in all major health retailers, which is very exciting, and delivers the equivalent of an NHS health check, but just in 9 minutes. So if you have concerns about your heart health, or if you want to share it with your friends and family, you can go to any one of the major high street pharmacy chains or go to pocdoc.co. Thanks as ever to PocDoc for supporting the show. Thanks, as I always say, to the amazing team at UK Health Radio and to all of the listeners who are listening live from across the world. UK Health Radio is now the largest talk health radio station in Europe and potentially everywhere outside the United States. Actually, Johan and his team do a phenomenal job. There are tons of other great presenters on the network. Have a listen. There's some amazing content out there. And every single show on UK Health Radio is also available on all of the podcast channels. That brings me on to saying thank you to everyone who's listening through any of the podcast channels. We are now available everywhere. We have downloads in over 50 countries every single month, which is absolutely wild, considering when we started 2.5 years ago. We barely had downloads from a single country, which is great. So thank you so much for being with us on this journey. Thank you so much for all of the support, the comments, the likes, the reviews. If you can take a couple of minutes to just rate us on any of the podcast channels, that really helps with the growth of what we're doing and to help spread the messages and to help shine a light on all of the amazing guests that we have and their missions. Speaking of which, last week's show, which was episode 118, we featured Morgan and Kelly, the co-founders of Percy Health, P-E-R-C-I, Percy Health, the world's first virtual cancer care service. So their mission is around what happens after cancer treatment, the traditional cancer treatment has stopped. So chemo, surgery, radio, the mental support, mental health support, physical support, physiotherapy, nutrition. Kelly made a really good point in the show, which is that there are many that in many cancers they are being or are starting to be reclassified as long-term conditions. There's more people living with cancer than there is dying from cancer in some cases, not all cases, and that may continue as treatments get better. So support after that frontline treatment's finished is going to become more and more important. If you are interested in cancer care, or you think anyone that you know might be, have a listen to episode 118. On today's show, we are changing direction completely and focusing on patient health records and the kind of utopia, if you like, of an open, democratic, easy to access, digitized, singular patient data record. Now, there might be people listening who aren't in health tech who might be thinking, well, that makes a lot of sense. And don't we already have that? And the truth is we don't. And it's a lot more complicated than it sounds. And that's why I'm super happy to have on the show today Mo Al-Ubaidli, who is one of the pioneers of the democratic patient health record movement, I guess. It's been his personal life mission, which is going rather well, as you'll hear, around how to create a hugely accessible, large, democratic patient health record. He's the CEO and founder of a business called Patients Know Best, which my company, PocDoc, is very proud to work with. They're an incredible company. And Mo, there couldn't be anyone better to lead us through this area. So Mo, welcome to the show. How are you?
I'm really good. Thank you, Steve. I'm really looking forward to the call today.
Yeah, good. Right, Mo, let's jump into it. So, as I said, there might be some people listening that kind of assume potentially that this is there already because it makes so much sense. Offset against that, you have the UK government and actually, I guess, lots of governments and organizations like the Tony Blair Institute and all kinds of different people, wonderful, very smart people saying we should have a central digitized patient health record. But let's just take a step back. Why is this so important to you, but also to the wider world? Like, give us the full background here so we get on the same page because we're quite a broad church as a show.
Sure. So it's important to everyone because figuring out what to do for your health requires you having all the information. And the information about your health normally comes from extremely qualified, extremely specialized people. And when they specialize, they end up breaking down a little bit of your body that they go very deep on. So somebody needs to stitch it back together so you can understand the whole of you. And far too often, that ends up falling to the patient as being the only way to do it. And the way I personally experienced this was I've got genetic immune deficiency, I've got a rare disease. So I've always been taught by my medical team to pay attention to look after myself. I mean, in my case, it started with a nurse who came to visit me. I was 16 years old, grumpy teenager, sat on a ward of what I perceived as 60-year-olds. They're probably 30-year-old, but I just thought they were all older than me. But I hated being there as any teenager would. And but it was life-saving as I got my infusion for my rare disease. And she said to me, "Do you want to learn how to do this yourself at home?" And before I could admit that I was scared of needles, she taught me how to inject myself and take care of myself. So that was life-changing. And I thought of her years later when I was talking to a doctor in the USA for a book I was writing about sharing medical records. And he'd started using it with his patients, and he'd made a mistake with one of his patients where he'd missed a cancer warning in the radiology report, but the patient picked it up.
Oh, wow.
And mistake, he's a human, of course, he makes mistakes. Every doctor does that every day. But his reaction was different because he then said to all his patients, "I need you to look at the information with me. I can't know everything myself. You're part of the team." And so that attitude change, got me thinking about, well, if we had a complete record and if you had an engaged patient, most of the care that gets delivered is actually done by the patient. So it's the diabetic who injects themselves, it's the asthmatic who uses the preventative inhaler. So actually, the really valuable record is being generated by the patient at home. And the most important and the most care actually gets done at home by the patient. So you need to have your whole health information. And you need to understand what it means so you can take actions yourself alongside all the professionals who help you out.
That, I mean, I can't imagine that there's anyone, many people, if any people listening that think that's not a good idea. You know what I mean? Like on a paper, it just sounds so logical to the point where I'm sure some people think, well, don't we already have that? So I guess what are some of the barriers that when we can jump into your journey with Patients Know Best in a second, but the background as to why this isn't as simple as it sounds.
So I think there's three barriers. So the first one is the specialization. And the Mayo Clinic in the USA, for example.
Yeah,
So
that's a
they were
huge. What are they, one of the largest private clinics in the world, or they're massive, aren't they?
they are very large, but they're also excellent. And so they started in 1905 by Taylor, the one who did time managing excellence and so on. And one of the things they did when they set it up was they had a trolley on the ward with all the notes. That was the first time any doctors agreed to do that because before then, every doctor would lock up their notes in their cabinet because their notes were their income. Right? So the special, and even though the doctors in Mayo Clinic did that, they still hid them from the nurses. The nurses had their own notes and so on. So one barrier is every specialist protects their notes and all of the advances in medicine are made by more specialists getting more specialized. So that's one operational difficulty. Then you get another thing, which is regulatory, because healthcare is so sensitive, and rightly so. People get really protective and they have all these laws, and then everyone panics, and it's just easier to do nothing and lock everything down than to join it up and be seen. You might make a mistake, and there's a lot of punishments around that. And the third thing for me, which I think all the government conversations around, a single national record would be good, is missing, is actually the really big trend is the largest data set and the most important data set isn't with the professionals anymore. It's with the patients. And no government has gotten their head around it. They're just trying to herd all the cats for all the doctors to join up their data, forgetting that the biggest opportunity is the devices at home, the patient at home. And PocDoc is an example of that, right? So it's not just that the PocDoc cholesterol test is a medical device, so it's as accurate as going to your hospital. It's that it's so low cost that you can do it so frequently that the quality of data goes above. In the 1980s, Omron, the blood pressure company, said, let's have people do their blood pressure tests at home. And everyone said that you're mad. Patients can't do blood pressures at home. Turns out they definitely can. And turns out they're more accurate than doctors because they're not stressed doing it in front of a doctor. But
Well,
the more
and
measures,
they haven't rushed to get to the doctor's surgery either.
all of these things, right? And then the more measurements you take, the more accurate they are on average. So the frequency that a PocDoc measurement allows makes it more accurate than the hospital occasional cholesterol result. Therefore, that the PocDoc is the most important long term. And no one's looking at that from a government level. They're all trying to do the GP record and the hospital record. So all these things together, that the specialists siloing things, the regulatory scaring people, and then missing out on the patient's data set makes this such a wicked problem to solve.
And it is, I mean, because it's not a new problem, right? I mean, it's been around for, well, I guess since the Mayo Clinic, people started like unlocking those cabinets and sharing the records. But so what was your from the kind of personal insight into the value of I guess patient-owned care, for want of a better word, when you were 16, how was that journey to then, and then after you were writing your book with the doctor that you found in oncology in the US, how did that all kind of coalesce into what is now Patients Know Best?
So I always knew I wanted to start a company, and the field I thought I would do it in was healthcare IT. So I went to medical school to become a programmer, not to practice as a doctor.
Cool.
And most med actually four of the medical schools immediately said, "Why are you here?" And they turned me down. But one of them said, "Okay." And I ended up every summer holiday I get a programming job. And when the professors know that you can program, they come to you saying, "Can you write this software for me?"
Right,
And of course,
because they all want to do some research and they all need programs to do it. No, they can't do that themselves.
correct. And then for me to write the software for the radiology professor, he has to teach me radiology.
Oh,
And for me to
nice.
write it for the cardiology professor, he has to teach me how the heart works so I can do it properly. So I got to learn programming and medicine at a very fast rate from that experience. And then I thought, I will, until I find the problem that I will dedicate my life to, I'm just going to work on lots of problems quickly so I can find which one most interesting. So I ended up writing six books about IT and healthcare. I learned by writing lots of different topics. And then one of them was that medical records where these hospitals were asking me, everyone's talking about sharing data with patients in 2007. Microsoft is launching a platform, Google's launching a platform. My CEO is asking about it, write a book for me. So could you do the research? That's how I ended up speaking to that physician with the cancer patient. And the stories just reminded me of me personally as a rare disease patient. I just thought, this really needs to happen. And it's annoying me that it's not happening. And so I've literally written the book about it. I'm going to focus on doing that. And that was 2008. The one insight I had in the States is that everyone assumed it's a technology problem, therefore the USA is the place to fix it. And it's not a technology problem. It's a trust problem. Therefore, the USA is the worst place to fix it. So I then left the UK and came back to the UK, the USA and came back to England in 2008.
So did you go to medical school in the US, did you say, or where did you go to medical school?
I went to Cambridge in England
Oh, okay.
and then did my house job in King's Lynn and
Okay.
then worked as a researcher in the USA for 6 years.
Oh, nice. Okay. And so what I think that's interesting about the US not being the place to solve this, because there is a bit of a well-trodden path of like, oh, you do okay in the UK and then you really go to the US to kind of quote unquote make it. Is that because of the
Yes.
uniqueness of the US healthcare system and the insurance companies and the how how the economics are kind of set up?
It's the economics. So basically, when it comes down to it, the US hospital would say to me, why would I give my customer's data, that's the patient's health record, to my competitor, that's the other hospital? So all of their systems, they call them personal health records, but they're really hospital portals. They would market them as customer service tools, but they're actually customer lock-in tools. So one of them told me that a patient who messaged their physician on their proprietary portal in a 12-month period was 85% less likely to go to another hospital during that 12-month period. So all of them were locking you into, because if you went to the other hospital, you wouldn't have the data from the first hospital, so you
You
stay in
get
that
it.
system.
Can you get it? Like, if let's say, for example, I decide it's a bit of an off topic, but this is why I like doing the show. It's a bit of a tangent. If I go to one hospital in the US and then for whatever reason, 6 months later or 9 months later, I turn up at a different hospital, can they get my records from the other hospital or is it hard?
So since late 90s, HIPAA said you can by law, but in practice, what does that manifest as? Well, they get to fax each other. So you fax and then you rescan it. Then in 2022, the federal government snapped and said you must do it digitally. But 95% of requests for the patient to get their record digitally are rejected.
Wow.
They are supposed to be
What?
fined for doing that, but in practice, they always come up with an excuse on the 95%, protecting your privacy. I'm not sure about this or that. That ends up being so. It ends up being a cartel of the digital coded structured data inside the hospital system records, and
Oh
the
my gosh.
providers and the vendors collude together to make it operationally difficult to comply with what everybody thinks should be done.
That just sounds horrendous, to be
It
honest, as
is.
far as a patient goes. That just sounds completely against, like, I don't know, whatever iteration of the Hippocratic Oath we're supposed to be
Yes.
following. I don't know. So I can see why you came back to the UK.
Yes.
And so how close is what patients know best now to what your original kind of vision was when you started the company?
So it's finally getting close, in the sense that the mission of the company is that the patient knows best, but we're not saying they do, although many of them do, but that our job is to explain to you what's happening with your health and advise you on what to do next based on the record. Now, to do that, I have to find your record for you, which is a lifetime of work. So we've finally gotten to the stage now where we can get your GP record for you as you register. We already have hospital data for you, 20 million test results every month, 100,000 people register for it, and so on. And device data is coming in, including PocDoc, that then you join up all the data sets in one go. But I guess, to answer your question, I'm only finally getting to do it now. It just took a lot of patience to go through it.
When you started and you started to talk to people about this, were people in the UK, I mean, in the US is a whole different kettle of fish. Let's talk about the UK. What were people's reaction, both clinicians and I don't know, people in and around? Did they get it or did they think that you were a complete lunatic?
No, I mean, I'd say 20% hated the name with a passion and just said you're really trying to annoy me. About 85% thought it was a stupid name, but who cares? I'm not going to do anything in favor or against. But 5% said yes. I mean, when the patient comes, they know what's happening. I ask them what's happening, and it turned out those 5% were the most knowledgeable doctors. And
Oh,
I
that's
didn't quite
interesting.
understand. Yeah, so everyone told me, the youngsters will get you, the oldies will be against you. Actually, it was often the most senior doctors, and it's because the more you know, the more confident you are in your knowledge and the less threatened you are by other people knowing. So the one who are most confident say, yeah, sure, I just ask the patient, we talk, and it gets done. Whereas often the juniors who are still learning would try and hide the things they didn't know. And so they were the ones who are against it. So luckily that 5% were the ones who pushed, put their own budgets behind it, often pushed against their colleagues who were scared of the problems this would show. And they were the ones who fought for this approach. So it was finding them in the beginning that mattered.
And was there any kind of rhyme or reason as to where those people were in the system? Because theoretically, you could work with anybody, right? Because it's all diseases, it's all conditions, it's hospital care, GP care, like it's everything. That's kind of why it's such a huge task.
So I began cold calling people who are dealing with patients with complex situations. So often they would be at the cutting edge of their professional career. They would have a bit of an innovation budget, but also the complexity of those patient situations required cooperation with other specialists, and none of them had a system that joined up all the specialists. So they had extreme data sharing problems. And then as a side effect, those patients were by necessity highly competent. They'd had time and need to learn about their condition. So those were the hotspots for going after.
A little bit like you back in the day when you were 16, those type of patients learning about their condition.
Exactly. And you know, not that any of us wanted to, but you end
No.
up in that case. And then, so in my case, I started off going back to the immunology team that diagnosed me in Great Ormond Street. It didn't work with them, but I then found a gastroenterologist in Great Ormond Street, Susan Hill, and she basically said to me, you know, she looks after children who can't eat through their mouth. They have to have it through a tube in their heart.
Right.
And she said to me, I really worry about these children. And you could tell she genuinely thinks about them every day. When they go to that emergency department, that doctor they see has never seen a child with that situation before. And the
Right.
person who really knows what the child needs is the mum. And the person they won't listen to is the mum. And they wait to fax back and forth to Great Ormond Street. So Susan wanted to give the information to the child with the mum so the mum could defend the child in the A&E department by saying, this is what Great Ormond Street says you have to do. I
Right.
know you have to do it. Please do it without waiting for the facts. That was how we started.
Wow. And is that became a genuine use case? That hypothetical that you just explained there.
Genuine use case. I mean, the first thing she did was she said, I'm going to send letters to the families. And, you know, Susan, of course, go ahead, but you know, we can do care plans, we can do test results. I've got some really snazzy stuff. Said, no, I just want to send a letter digitally. And she calls me the next day and says, I sent five letters and one of the mums came back with a correction. And she said, I know my letters are full of errors. No one corrects me. I've been a consultant 15 years. But
Yeah.
because it was so easy for them to feedback, she fixed it for me. And then she said, what else can I send? Because the faster I send, the faster they fix. And she
Oh,
had that
nice.
attitude. Then the next jump off was about 3 years later when one of the children she was looking after became 18 and went to the adult services in St. Mark's Hospital. So that consultant suddenly had access to the record. He used to get everything printed and rewritten. He then instantly had access to students' notes and said, I want this for all 300 adults that I look after. And then it began snowballing. But it was from
Wow.
these sort of champions who would follow those use cases and those patients.
It's just, I think it's such a testament to the value of creating a brilliant product that solves patient and clinician needs at the same time in its entirety. Some people call it like patient or user-centric design, but it's a great example. Like, you only get that type of virality, if you want to coin a phrase, if it is a really good product.
I was going to say, so we're not as viral as
Well,
we
within
deserve to
health,
be, but
you know,
within
within our industry,
healthcare,
right?
such a serious problem. And a lot of it was around the movement, right? So when you get a Susan or those mums or Simon Gabe, the doctor, those people are so focused on fixing the problem for their patients that you then give them an environment in which they can cooperate when often the system is so much against that, whether it's through regulation or finances and so on. But that's what I enjoyed when I was writing my books. It's what can technology do that lets people doing the work do the work at a disruptively low price that means senior management doesn't get involved.
Yeah.
They can just buy it with their own budget and get on with it.
Brilliant. I love it. We're going to go for our first commercial break now. We will be back in 2 minutes with Mo Al-Obaidli, who is the CEO and founder of Patients Know Best, which is the UK, maybe more than the UK, but certainly the UK's leading personal health record provider, who's revolutionizing the space of personal health patient records. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
The station that makes you feel good. The station that makes you feel good.
Hello and welcome back to this week's Health Tech Hour with me, Steve Roost, and my guest today, Mo, the co-founder and CEO of Patients Know Best. So Mo, we were kind of covering before the break, like the sort of origins and the wares and the amazing narratives and sort of user stories about why Patients Know Best makes so much sense in the context of the healthcare system. But how has that kind of evolved from those beginnings into where you are now? I don't know if you want to share how many users and things like that you've got. I know you've got some announcements planned, but like, what has that kind of evolution been? Has it gained momentum in the last 2 years? Has it slowed down? Like, what, you know, do you feel like now is the time, or are there still like massive hurdles? Or could you give us a bit of color on all of that?
Sure. So we're over 4.9 million users, and we add 100,000 every month. So you can guess the announcement that we'll be able to do something.
I can. I'm not a mathematician, but I'm pretty confident I can guess that one.
So we're almost there, but the momentum you're talking about has really increased following COVID, because we integrated with the NHS app and then everyone began using the NHS app.
Yep.
So that then began fixing the problem of people knowing about the system and claiming their record. So, you know, when we started, you'd have to wait for Susan to invite the child or invite the mum to have access. When we got our first contract in Northwest London in 2015, 2.4 million people contract, but in 3 years, only 3,000 people registered, because every time a doctor sees a patient, they can think of a reason why this particular patient shouldn't get access to their record.
Right.
2018, a month before they were about to kill the whole thing because it was going too slowly. Mm. They switched it on the kiosk. So when you go and check into the clinic, you'd get told you want your record. And in that 1 month, 3,000 people said yes. So the same as the previous 3 years combined.
Right.
And so when you didn't, when you offered it to everyone, everyone said yes.
Yeah. I imagine if you offer access to your record to patients, like the uptakes, if you make it obvious that's what you're offering and you don't bury it in something and you don't disguise it, like the uptake's got it, when it's a proper clean ask, the uptake's got to be pretty high, hasn't it?
So we found about 25% uptake at the kiosks, but if you had a test result in your record, there was a 95% uptake. So
That's
basically
mental.
People could just tell, someone just took my blood, I want to know the answer. And so it's just about removing the friction for you to be able to hear the offer and take it up. So the NHS login inside the NHS app allowed people to do that as a really large scale. So as 2020 started and the COVID passport began being used and PKB was right there next to it, that's when it kicked into 100,000 people a month rather than 3,000 people a month.
That's crazy. And what is the backstory? Because I'm guessing that you're a fan of the NHS app. And I'm not sure those teams get enough credit for doing what they did with the NHS app. I don't know if you agree with me, but like, it was a huge step. I don't know of any other, I guess, Western highly developed healthcare system that has anything similar. Like, for example, the US definitely doesn't, like your point. It's like, it's in the dark ages. So I don't know. Do you feel the same, or would you take a different view?
No, I completely agree. And if I just expand on that global survey. So I've just written a book called Personal Health Records for Governments, where I looked at different countries, 16 nations, and I classify them as mostly being one of two extremes. So one is the US, like you're saying, where there's nothing from the government in terms of identity or single front door. And it's basically, I call them Mad Max. It's a whole bunch of IT systems that make you jump through all these punitive user agreements, and they're all trying to lock you in.
Yeah.
And keep you away from the rest. And then at the other end, for entertainment, I call them Soviet, in that they're basically, the government builds one system, they do it with the right intentions, but it just becomes, the whole stack is owned by the government and it can't be, and it's basically frozen in time and budget. They haven't changed it since the first thing, and they're kind of panicking about how to do it. Now, the HS England team, when they launched the HS app in 2018, everybody expected them to go down that route. And I could see the pressure as everybody expected them to do everything, which not only did they say they weren't doing everything, but also they shouldn't be doing everything. It's not possible for any. Now, So in parallel to that pressure they were under, our customers came to my colleagues and said, PKB really needs to work with the NHS app. And I didn't know how to do it. But my colleague said, no, we can do this. We know people in the NHS app team, they're friendly, they're open, we can do it. So my colleagues pushed based on the customer request to work with the NHS app team. And exactly as they were saying, they were very open, they were very collaborative. Basically, every week we'd go back and forth saying, well, here's a feature of PKB. Could we put it inside the NHS app because it shows test results? And they'd say, yeah, we need the following things based on our research. And we back designs back and forth. It was a very cooperative environment. And so what the English government has done with the NHS app is that they've created a marketplace for lots of solutions to be purchasable by the public purse and exposed in the NHS app. So the public sector gets the best of the private sector, and the public gets the control, the brand, the governance of the public sector. And I haven't seen any other country do that. England has been a real pioneer, and the citizenry has benefited as a result.
And if you use the app, right, it works quite well. You know what I mean? Like it, like shockingly well for something that's sort of developed within a government institution. Like it works.
And again, Steve, it's particularly hard for them because the specification must change every few months because there's new technology and new offerings. So as you move the, as you change the engine, you've still got to pilot the plane. And so they're doing that with government level scrutiny. You know, everyone's having a go at you. Government level scale, every mistake gets magnified for, but they're still brave enough to keep doing it.
Well, and also, like, I can only imagine the fear in that team around like data breaches and getting hacked and all. I mean, it must be like off the charts high. So I think they deserve a huge amount more credit than I've ever. I guess I've not really seen anything publicly. That's really given them, I think, the credit that that team deserves, to be honest. It just doesn't really come. It's almost like an assumption. It's like, oh yeah, we've got the app and the app does this stuff.
Tell you what, so when I wrote the book in 2007, I was really struck that the best examples of data sharing were done by the US federal government, the VA, which is about half the size of the NHS, the people they look after.
Is that right? Is that big?
Yeah,
Wow.
but the Americans are embarrassed about it because it's the public sector doing better than the private sector, and it ideologically they don't like to talk about it, but it's really good. So they went
That's
full
so
on
interesting.
transparency early on, and they did it with, you know, people 60 plus, the veterans basically. And it took me so much effort to get a press at any documentation out there because they had to get five levels of approval, and they were almost shy about what they were doing. Meantime, all the private providers, every day they were giving me press releases trying to get coverage, and they were offering their model is about lock-in. So I think I find the same thing in all public sector, in every government. There, it's a thankless task. Everyone is in public complaining about you. It's an easy target, but they just quietly get on with it. I think it's in every country, and NHS app team, like you're saying, they haven't had enough coverage or praise for the middle path they've chosen.
And how do you, let's talk about a little bit more on this book of personal health records for governments. Where do you, I'm not quite sure what the right term for these is, so forgive me if I'm a bit cack-handed at this point, but like these countries that have almost like a blank slate and quite a large checkbook to start things from scratch, like for example Saudi Arabia and NEOM and other countries in the Middle East, Singapore maybe, not quite sure if that fits, but there's not a lot of legacy infrastructure there, or there's little legacy that they can't just do away with and start from scratch again. Like how, what's your take on whoever you feel fits into that category, if I have defined it correctly, which I may not have?
No, I think you picked out the right countries. So Saudi Arabia, as you say, has a little bit of a blank slate, but also a very statist. The Saudis are perfectly fine with going top down. In England, you have to justify it and hand-wring over it, but the Saudis make no apology. It's how they operate. So they just said there will be a single shared record for every Saudi citizen across every provider, public and private. You will put a copy of the data in there, and then they said we will expose it via their app is called Sahati, which is Arabic for My Health, and it will be government-owned brand, free to the consumer, and so on. So they just get
Just
on
do
with it
it.
and do it. Correct. Now, I still find that they then get stuck on bringing innovation from outside, but they do get to move quickly, and they do manage with vertical integration in a pretty sophisticated way. So, as a small example, part of their plans is by having all the data about everything inside your Revit in one single shared care record, they know about every operation that's happening.
Okay.
Therefore, they can text the person after the operation and say, "How was it? What happened?" So the central regulator can then check a sample of every provider's operations and expose that publicly, saying, "This provider is getting good feedback from the patients,
Okay.
this one isn't."
Do they have the
Again,
ability, do patients have the ability to choose provider like that in Saudi or not? I
they
don't.
do. Well,
Okay.
they do. Obviously, anyone can pay for private, and
Right.
there's some insurance coverage and so on. And private and public is 50-50, rather than in the UK, it's 90-10.
Yeah.
But there isn't so much freedom of information. So they're trying to fix that transparency, and they just can plan to just get on with it through certain centralizations that I find in Europe. People don't do. So as another example, the largest database I could find by any government, it sort of stops at 5 million, sort of Denmark size.
Right.
Sweden, they only do it, although it's 10 million population, they divide it by province, so it's 1 million at most.
Okay.
Saudi Arabia just says 8 million, we're doing it.
Right.
So there are
Cool.
advantages and there are risks, but that's how watching different countries' approaches is useful. That's kind of what I find interesting in the book.
Yeah, I think so. And like, how did you find the time to write a book and do what you're doing? Like, what, let's talk about this. How long does a book take to write? Like, what does one do?
So I and my colleague Federica, who's done most of the work, by the way, we started on this 2 years ago.
Okay.
And when I said we're doing this, we were definitely going to do it in a year. So it took 2 years rather than one. It always takes longer. Part of it is if you're learning something you find interesting, the time flies. And part of it is that it helps you back and forth. So when you're, I hear you when you do your shows, Steve. You're taking down notes from everyone. You're basically learning the entire health industry one episode at a time,
That
and so
helps.
it's very valuable. It helps you for the business as well as for your intellectual learning, and then it builds relationships with people.
That's true.
So really, it's about just giving yourself time to do that.
Cool. Okay. Well, look, let's go to the last commercial break and then we'll be back in the last part of the show, Mo. I really want to dig into this idea that I've heard from governments and I would say sort of think tanks, you know, to coin a phrase around, well, if we have a centralized care record and everything's all in the care record, then we can do some really whizzy AI and save lots of lives. You know what I mean? So like this, like let I want to dig into that because I do, but I'm being a bit disingenuous. I do believe that is the truth, but I do also believe that potentially there's a lot of people that talk about that without really some idea about exactly how that's going to happen. So I'd love to get your thoughts on it because you're obviously at the forefront. So
You're
we
very
will be
polite,
back
Steve.
in 2 minutes with the last part of today's show with Mo, the CEO and co-founder or founder of Patients Know Best. We'll be right back.
The station that makes you feel good. UK Health Radio. The station that makes you feel good.
Hello, and welcome to the last part of this week's Health Tech Hour with me, Steve Roost, and my guest today, Mo, the founder and CEO of Patients Know Best. So, before the break, Mo, I sort of hinted that maybe we could spend some time in this last part talking about what I've heard. Certainly, politicians and other think tanks talking about, which is that when we get to this patient record that's centralized and digitized, then that unlocks the door for AI to work its magic and create such unbelievable savings and future health benefits that, you know, will all be all healthcare systems will be saved and the governments will save lots of money, being slightly flippant. But what's your kind of take on this? And I don't know, maybe you feel like that's not what they're saying, in which case, feel free to challenge.
No, that's 100% what they're saying. Look, the AI one is, I'll give you two ways of looking at it. So early during COVID, I caught up with the team that analyzed kidney data. Do you remember Royal Free with DeepMind and so on? And they had all this AI that was going to predict who would go into kidney failure. And I sat with one of the doctors, as in on the tech side. I said, so what did you discover in your AI? They said the biggest predictor was the blood test that the doctor ordered for the patient as they came in. Basically, the doctor would order a blood test if they thought you were about to have kidney failure. So actually, the doctor is the one who predicted you had kidney failure, and now the AI has picked up that the blood test is the predictor. So
Yeah, there's like a
that's
horse barn door situation there, isn't there?
it. So did we really need AI to tell us that? But at the same, but within a couple of months, DeepMind did the folding protein analysis, which suddenly just fixed entire tranches of biology instantaneously, as far as I can tell, right? So the rate of evolution is really insane in AI, and there's no point in me saying that AI can't do this, because just wait a bit, it'll just change.
Yeah, I
So
mean, like tomorrow they might come out with an announcement that makes this look completely out of date.
correct. So then what really matters isn't predictions about AI. It's more, what does AI need to compute? It needs a data set. And yes, joining up the data is useful, but I find a lot of the government and think tanks' definition of the data is missing the most important data set, which is actually from the patient in the home with these new devices. That's a much larger data set, and they normally dismiss it as not as good as the doctors. But actually, I think it will get better than the doctors every day, and because it's the price is falling at chip prices, Moore's Law prices, then the frequency of doing that skyrockets. So I think they're missing the really big data set that matters for
And it
AI.
is are they mis are they missing it because it's hard to access it in its entirety, because it's sort of by definition person to person and lots of different companies, lots of different variables, or is there something else going on?
What I found with government efforts to do this, and with the caveat that I, like you're saying, completely admire what they're doing, they always get told off and no one gives them praise for what they're doing. But they start with the locus of control they have. So they often go for the data sets that they have commissioned. So they, whether it's in England getting data from NHS providers or Catalonia getting only the data from government-funded care, not the private sector. That's within their span of control. So they build a data set around that one. And then they get into a governance model where adding the outside data sets, forget the private provider, just the data in the home, that freaks them out from the architecture they built. So then they lock themselves into a silo. And it's a common pattern. I get why they end up in that way. A lot of it is their hands are tied. But I see that consistently, which is why you end up needing an architecture which is around the citizen, not the government, which gives you the flexibility to go full tech on this around a complete data set.
And is that where Patients Know Best has excelled? Because I feel like, without obviously knowing the inside of your business, I feel that's kind of where you guys are at, which is that you have the ability to work with PocDoc, or, I mean, God, goodness knows how
Yes.
many providers you work with, but you also integrate directly back up into the healthcare system in a manner which it can ingest.
That's how we start from day one. And that quote I gave you, which is the hospital saying, why would I give my customers' data to my competitor? That was the architecture they were against. But that's how we started in PKB. And in the beginning, we were only allowed to do it, 35 children in Great Ormond Street, 300 adults in St Mark's. It took a while for it to snowball. But once it does, it then becomes a superior approach to the hospital or government approach. But it took a while to get to there.
Yeah, and how do you see this field area kind of advancing? Because there's obviously a lot of investment going into it. I think the government's made a, well, I don't know quite what's going to actually happen, but they certainly made a big splash about, I don't know how many billions of pounds to be invested in doing this or something like that. So what do you think the next 1 to 3 years looks like here?
So I think every government's role will be three things. One is to create a good data set for the country. So the things that are under their control, they get it in the right format. So not locked down by particular medical records companies' formats. It's got to be transparent and available, file for people to build things on top. And then they need to get the identity verification layer right. So the NHS login is amazing.
Agreed.
So the Irish don't have it, the Canadians don't have it, goodness knows the Americans don't have it, and therefore patient access records is severely hampered as a
And
result.
just to jump in here, with one thing that probably I don't know anyone, well, there might be some people listening, but a lot of people don't realize that the NHS login infrastructure architecture is so good that they have a way, which is called ODS, which is a bit of a technical term, that just by using a postcode and a name and a date of birth, you can automatically look up someone's NHS number and find that record, which is crazy.
This is years of work, right? This doesn't
It's
happen overnight.
insane. Is it? But like, I feel like people don't understand the scale of how difficult just that problem is, and how well the NHS has actually solved that.
And England has gone beyond solving from a technical perspective. There's also from a policy perspective. So NHS login works in Wales and England, but Wales has locked it down a lot more than England. Therefore, England has a lot more innovation than Wales does. And the third thing they need to do is get the user agreements correct through government purchasing power. So the things you can sign up for in the USA are quite different to what the NHS app mandates all its suppliers to go through. And then if you look at India, for example, they're even better at what they've put down in all kinds of healthcare regulation. So those are the three things government should be doing: the data there, their control, the identity verification, and the regulatory environment. That then creates the ability for the innovators who are really multinational. They really need to spread their R&D budget across multiple countries and not be locked into any one country to then deploy across all those countries that have the right environment. And so England is at the cutting edge of that, but it must not believe that it is the totality of a market. They must allow suppliers who work in multiple countries to get then their VC investment to do the R&D that's required at scale.
I think
And so that's what I'm looking for.
that's a really interesting final point, which I want to kind of dig in to make sure everyone listening really sort of appreciates that, which is, and Mo, jump in as well. But I think what you're getting at there is that in order to build really big businesses and to secure enough funding to solve this massive issue at scale,
Yes.
you need to take in investment from venture capital funds who will need to see more of a market than just England. Like, to even to your point, we don't even have
Yes. Yeah.
England plus Wales, because Wales does it different, let alone Scotland,
Correct.
right? So there does need to be some commonality, or at least like some translatable, what do you call it, like some kind of translation between doing it in one place and doing it in another in order
Exactly.
to get the
Yes.
scale.
I mean, I don't know if you read Tony Blair's book on governing, but there's one analogy about it which he tells governments is that your job is to build the airport, not the airplane, because the airplane requires investment across multiple countries. It's a very large investment. No government should do it. But your job is to make a good airport that any airplane can land in, and that's how you expand your economy. That should be the government's digital infrastructure for healthcare.
That and how close do you think our current government is aligning itself with that analogy?
I think it's one of the closest compared to other governments, but most go but it's a struggle for, and I think it's a struggle for governments because they have such scrutiny and such expectations put upon them. But I guess that's why Tony Blair wrote that book with his way of suggesting things, whispering behind the scenes.
I think it's a great analogy. It makes total sense. And it also kind of makes you realize how messed up the US is based on what you just said around this particular issue. Because
Yes.
actually the private market is working specifically against its customers, i.e. the people that pay for insurance. It's
Yeah, it
like that the whole idea of a private market should be that the consumer's ability to choose and to spend money creates competitive pressure, which improves the service, which it
I
isn't.
spoke to I spoke to a founder from the UK who went to the States and his company was acquired, and now he's sort of head of innovation, this massive US tech company. And I said to him, so I look at the USA and just see them wildly inefficient. He goes, no, you're missing the USA is incredibly efficient. When I run my services at scale, and he runs operations across multiple states,
Sure.
my cost basis is embarrassing compared to the UK's. We're so efficient, it's unbelievable. However, what the US does is, having been efficient, the private companies take up that margin. So it
Right.
doesn't get passed back to the consumer or to the payer, or to the government. It
Yeah.
gets pocketed by the private sector to astonishing amounts. And I don't know how they're going to get out of that problem. I mean, I thought when I was in the States in 2003, that was the year that the m amount that General Motors spent per car on the healthcare costs of their employees was more than on the steel of the car.
Is
So
that
I thought
right? Is that
that's
right?
2003. It's since gone
What?
through. So I thought that's the point at which the US will change, because the US is corporatist rather than.
Yeah.
That will be what the lobbying,
Yeah.
the changes. It hasn't worked. It just continued to get worse. So I don't know how they will do it. But on the flip side, 2003 was also the first year that the US allowed text messaging between mobile phone companies. Before, AT&T could only message AT&T, and they announced it on this new TV show called America's Got Talents with
No
Simon Link.
way. That's
So they were just
amazing.
right. So you look at the US as a complete backwater. They only just allowed text messaging. And then 3 years later, they released the iPhone and they leapfrogged the entire world. So when they eventually get there, they do it amazingly. But I can't call it when they'll do it.
So there are there kind of like companies in this data, patient data space in the US, or is it kind of like a desert for those type of plays right now because of the setup?
All of the ones that I saw doing this in 2007, and to your point, this is an obvious idea, everyone knows it should be done, were gradually bankrupted over the following years. And even the big cos like Google and Microsoft were just pushed away because of the cartel approach of this. So I don't know how it will get solved. I believe in America it does solve problems, but goodness knows they've taken the long way around to it.
And do you have any concerns? And feel free just to kind of pass on this question, it's completely fine. Do you have any concerns because Optum, which is now was in, now owns Emis, and Emis is like what 50% of the market of GP records, right? Do you think that's going to have any issues for us down the track, or you maybe don't have an opinion? I don't know.
No, I think there's good regulation in place that limits people's abilities. But I don't know if people in the UK are aware of what happened to Optum and United in the last 12 months. So about a third of payments to doctors for care get come through Optum stack in the USA. And
Right.
there was a data breach last year, which is a problem. And there is a, sorry, the ransomware brought down the payments infrastructure. So several months, all these doctors were having to do things for free at their own expense. And then United began lending them money at high prices.
Oh, no
And so all
way.
these people are stressed. So I don't understand how they can do that, but
Oh, my
that's
God.
more of my observation.
That sounds crazy. Right, we're into the last couple of minutes of the show. This show's been absolutely fascinating. Thank you, Mo. So I use this last bit. I ask everyone the same question, which is, what kind of mantra or motto or phrase have you turned to through the years, when things have been difficult that you think might benefit the listeners to share?
I don't have a mantra, but what I like is a podcast by Guy Raz called How I Built This. And I like it because he interviews amazing founders. And obviously, the usual formula, it goes through trials and tribulations, and there are many. But I liked it during lockdown because I always knew the ending was going to be, it was a happy ending.
Right.
And you and I know most endings are actually terrible.
Yep.
But it was, I could go through that bedtime story of it starts off hard, but it's going to be all right. And he gets them to speak up. A lot of them tell things they've never told anyone before. So
Right.
that's the one I enjoy.
Brilliant. Thank you very much. And that's How I Built This by Guy Raz.
Yes,
Okay. And if people want to find out more about Patients Know Best or sign up, what do they do? Where do they go?
patientsknowbest.com/register.
And anyone can do it in the UK.
England and Wales, as we
England and
discussed.
Wales. Cool. Yeah, thank you. England and England and Wales. Right, perfect. Mo, thank you very much for coming on.
Real pleasure. Thank you.
And thank you to everyone for listening. We'll be back again next week with another show.
Up at you when the morning comes, I watch you.